You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome to The Transfer Window, the podcast that brings you the news before it becomes news. And this week we will remind you of a time in 2018 when we did just that with a story about the biggest club in English football that is once again rearing its head. Hello and welcome to the Transfer Window. I'm Johnny McFarlane, and joining me today, as ever, is transfer guru and pundit extraordinaire, Mr. Duncan Castles. Duncan, let me hear your dulcet tones.
What would you like to hear, Johnny? Let's tell the listeners what we're going to give them on this first post-January Transfer Window episode of the Transfer Window podcast.
Well, we're going to have an overview of this transfer window. Perhaps deadline day wasn't too exciting in the end, but there's lots to talk about what happened overall. We're going to touch on Manchester United as well as other big clubs in the Premier League and beyond. Duncan, let's start with how the biggest club in England, Manchester United, ended up with a 30-year-old Nigerian as their new striker in the midst of a cultural reboot when they were supposed to be looking at younger players with a different style of profile and only going out to buy the guys that they felt could make a difference over the long term.
Yeah, it's been an extraordinary January window from Manchester United. As you say, the line from the club, from Ed Woodward, from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, from internal briefings has been, we are changing, we're building for the future, we are culturally rebooting the squad. I lost count of the number of times Solskjaer went into press conferences saying we will only buy a player if he is good for the long-term plan for the club. Yet what we see them doing on the final days of the window are bidding for a Bournemouth striker who has been out since the end of December with a hamstring injury and wouldn't have been fit to play. Josh King, 28-year-old, reasonable Premier League player, but I don't think anyone has really ever thought of him as being the answer to Manchester United's attempt to get into the Champions League for the first time in 2 years. They made, I can tell you, an inquiry about another Bournemouth forward, Ryan Fraser, the Scotland international, which eventually came to nothing. But again, another good player, but you wonder how exactly Fraser fits into that pronounced strategy of the club. And then eventually they end up signing Odion Ighalo. As you say, about to turn 31 in the summer. Good goal scorer for Nigeria. I think he has 16 and 35 for Nigeria, albeit five of those goals came in a two-match period against Libya, who I think are currently ranked 101 in the world. Player who, again, hasn't played any football since December, in his case, since the beginning of December. He spent a lot of last year missing matches for his team, Shanghai, because of a hamstring injury. I think between May and September, he didn't play any games for Shanghai, although he did manage to go in the middle of that period to the African Nations Cup and score a lot of goals for Nigeria in that tournament. Interestingly, a player that Louis van Gaal tried to sign in 2016, January window, a £35 million offer to Watford at the time, which I actually reported in the Sunday Times following that window, one that Watford turned down. And interestingly, a player that Van Gaal was looking at to try and save his season, to try and save his job at Manchester United, and to try and get the goals that would put them into the Champions League the next season, which ultimately didn't happen. It's a lot further on down the line. in terms of Ighalo's career. Spent a lot of time in China since then. Very well paid over there. This is not a cheap deal. Manchester United have spent a considerable amount on the loan fee and on the wages. They have an option to buy. They're not committed to keeping the player beyond the summer. But is that, how does that fit with the cultural reboot? How does that fit with the strategy of improving the squad and only doing deals that will improve the squad? Is he a good enough player for Manchester United? I talked to someone who knew him well at Watford. He said that in the period in which Watford had that bid from Manchester United, which they turned down, or subsequent to that period, Watford were actually looking to replace the player and upgrade the player. They turned it down because they felt they could get more money from Manchester United. But they didn't see Ighalo as a long-term solution for them in the Premier League. He says that Ighalo's quite a selfish player. He can score goals. He does have one very good trick that he used to beat defenders a lot in the Premier League, but people will work that out before too long. And kind of surprised that, as most people are, that Manchester United went there. The Josh King approach, I believe there were two offers to Bournemouth. Initially, Manchester United trying to take him on loan with an option to buy. Bournemouth resisted that. And United offered, I'm told, £20 million and then £25 million for King. And there's a common denominator amongst all these players. And the common denominator is an agent, actually Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's agent, called Jim Solbakken. And I believe you've got some audio for us from a December 2018 podcast where we discuss Solskjaer's appointment as interim Manchester United manager and his history of working with Solbakken in his previous jobs.
Absolutely. I'm just going to rub Duncan's bald dome now to get this audio ready for you. And here it is.
I honestly think if Solskjaer delivers and he doesn't need to deliver anywhere near the level that Di Matteo did in his caretaker period, then the Glazers will seriously think about hiring him because, as we've said many times in this podcast, the Glazers are about money. They're not about football. And if they can see a surer way to make an easier way to make profit with Solskjaer in charge of the club, that will be very appealing to them. And just one last thing on Solskjaer. There's a very interesting article published by a Norwegian magazine, or republished by a Norwegian magazine called Josimar, which I would urge Manchester United fans to have a look at, about Solskjaer's transfer dealings in previous management positions. They detail his relationship with an agent called Jim Solbakken, who was his own personal agent as a player and with whom he actually ran a player agency until the Federation forced him to sell his shares in the agency because he ran the risk of signing players from an agency that he owned himself, which would be an obvious conflict of interest. And they point out that in his it was written in 2014, this article originally, and they point out that 21 of the deals he'd made as Manchester United reserve manager, Molde manager, and then Cardiff City manager had been for players represented by Solbakken, and that three of the deals he made as soon as he came into Cardiff City were Solbakken players, three Norwegian, two signed from Molde and one from, I think, PSV Eindhoven, and the three of them made just six Premier League appearances between them. And people in Cardiff will say that the money spent on those players when he had the opportunity coming in around this time of year to try and save Cardiff from relegation, and they were outside the relegation when he took area when he took over. Money wasted on them contributed to ultimately being relegated, and Solskjaer eventually losing his job halfway through the following season in the Championship. So interesting to note and read and think about if Solskjaer manages to get a hold on some kind of transfer decision making at Manchester United down the line.
Well, that's remarkably prescient stuff, Mr. Castles. I think you called it, fair to say.
Well, look, this, as I said, there comes from an article written by a Norwegian, very good Norwegian football magazine called Josimar. It's an article that you can find on the internet easily. If you read that article now, you will see that at the top of it, it mentions that Solbakken took legal action against them over the article. Obviously, the article is still on the website. Therefore, I think that gives you a sense of whether Josimar's reporting was accurate or not. When you look into the detail of it, and I would encourage people to read it because it is fascinating, you will see that in the period that Solskjaer was first manager of Manchester United reserves, then manager of Molde, and then manager of Cardiff City, he signed 21 players from Jim Solbakken's football agency for those clubs. And we're talking players who joined Manchester United, Josh King, one of those players, as well as players who joined Cardiff and Molde. Now, that agency was an agency that Solskjaer co-founded with Solbakken. They've been friends since 1991. Solskjaer was forced to divest himself of his shares in the agency at a certain point by the FA because the FA don't allow, the Football Association in England don't allow coaches to own shares in player agencies for obvious reasons. Subsequent to that, he carried on signing players from Solbakken. So the three signings he made at Cardiff City of Norwegian players in his first January window, there are players who were intended to keep the club up, were all Solbakken clients. They made a grand total of 6 Premier League starts between them in that half season they were at Cardiff and were supposed to be helping the club avoid relegation. Obviously, the club went down. In the subsequent season, Solskjaer was sacked by Cardiff, with them headed towards the wrong end of the Championship table.
Duncan, isn't there just an argument, though, that Solskjaer is operating in a small pool? Norway's like Scotland. It's a very small environment in terms of football. There's a lot of people rubbing shoulders with each other because, you know, there's not a vast array of different agents that you can work with like there is in the Premier League.
I think you can make that argument. I think if you want to make that argument, I encourage you to read the piece and read the detail of how Solbakken and Solskjaer set up camps for young Norwegian players, run by their agency, which essentially, with Manchester United coaches coming over to some of those camps to coach the players. As Josimar describes it, it gave them the opportunity to sign up the best young players in Norway at that age, and then for Solbakken and the company to make profits from them down the line. There are also a couple of deals where Manchester United are involved when Solskjaer was the reserve manager at Manchester United. So you have the 2009 Mami Biram Diouf transfer, one that Sir Alex Ferguson, who was the manager at the time, apparently when the player was signed, admitted that he hadn't seen the player before that transaction was made. And another one, a year later, 2010, Anders Lindegaard, goalkeeper from Alisson's FK, signed for £4 million. Solbakken had been the player's agent until the deal was done, according to Josimar. An alternative agent was brought in to represent the player at the time the transaction was concluded, with Solbakken becoming the club's agent, i.e. Manchester United's agent in the deal. That alternative agent that was brought in is a business partner of Solbakken's called Atta Aneki. Now, who is Atta Aneki? Atta Aneki is the Norwegian-Nigerian agent who represents Odion Ighalo. So the connections there are fascinating. What I can tell you for sure is that Solbakken was making calls through this window trying to get deals set up for Manchester United, Ryan Fraser being one of those. He was asking, I'm told, whether it would be possible to get him out of Bournemouth and bring him to Manchester United and what the financial terms involved and that would be. As I say, it didn't progress, and Ryan Fraser is still at Bournemouth out of contract in the summer and looking for a new club. But there are questions being asked about why Manchester United end up trying to sign players like Josh King and Odion Ighalo, who are clearly contrary to their stated transfer policy in the very last days of the window. And some other interesting stuff going on around Solbakken, in which Josimar have also reported and other people have reported in Norway. He has been named as the agent of a Senegalese player, Babacar Sarr, who played for Molde under Solskjaer and was released from his contract and allowed to move first to Russia and then to Saudi Arabia after he had been accused of rape, actually multiple cases of rape in Norway. He's still has an arrest warrant out for him, but there is no extradition deal with Saudi Arabia, so Norwegian authorities haven't been able to conclude that trial. It's not a pretty picture, I think it would be a summary of what the Norwegian media has reported on in extensive detail. And as I say, I'd refer the listeners to that if they want to dig into this a bit more.
Was there any other interest that United had in players in that window, Duncan, that perhaps people aren't aware of?
Well, look, there was discussion about Edinson Cavani as the option to come in and sort out their attacking problems. In many ways, a much more natural fit if you're looking for, if you're going to take an older player to get you through the second half of the season with the view of getting one or two more good seasons out of him. Cavani's ended up staying at Paris Saint-Germain with Atletico's president complaining about the player's relatives and agents and their financial demands. Cavani's brother has responded to those comments from the Atletico president by saying that he wanted to go to Atletico, and if it had only been about money, he could have gone to Manchester or Chelsea instead. So there was obviously an attempt there to get a player who has a track record of scoring at the top level of football, and it would obviously be a better fit to what Manchester United are trying to do than the player they ended up recruiting in this January window.
What about the window overall, Duncan? I was sitting in the office reporting on every coming and going on deadline day, and it was one of the quietest that I have seen. Were you impressed with the work done by many clubs over that period?
It was a very quiet deadline day. Just looking at the Deloitte figures, they give us their estimates of spending immediately after the windows closed, and it has to be underlined that these are estimates because they haven't had the chance to properly check all of these figures. And they report there was only £25 million spent by Premier League clubs on deadline day, which is one of the lowest totals for a long time. The gross spend in the January window was very high, £230 million, up 28% on last year, second highest ever spend in a January window by the Premier League. The spend for the season, similar, £1.6 billion for the season is Deloitte's estimate. That's up 14%, again the second highest ever after the 17-18 season. Couple of interesting things are that just 2% of the money spent was spent between Premier League clubs. So you see that reluctance that clubs have to deal with each other, which I think is probably exacerbated by the tightness of this Premier League once you go away from the title race, which is clearly the least tight it's ever been. But you have so many clubs condensed into a very small point differential at the bottom end of the division, so many clubs threatened by relegation, and a lot of clubs fighting for that fourth Champions League place, and they clearly do not want to sell to each other in the window and lose important players or even risk giving their rivals some small advantage by letting them have a player that's not particularly important to them. Across Europe, we've got record spends as well. Every one of the big five leagues has spent more on transfer fees this season than they've ever done before, apart of course from England. And the total gross spend is a record 6.45 billion euros on transfer fees from those five leagues, England, Spain, France, Germany and Italy for this season, which is a quite incredible amount of money.
The biggest deal was West Ham, on deadline day, obviously, taking Jared Bowen from Hull City. Do you think that's a move that will be a good one for David Moyes over the long term? Young player, a lot of potential?
Yeah, it's an intriguing deal. Like you say, it was the biggest on deadline day. It ended up being for an initial £14 million with £8 million of potential bonuses involved. So it's pretty much as West Ham spent as much on Jared Bowen as all the other Premier League clubs spent together on their deadline day deals. David Sullivan, I think, did this deal under duress. I'm told that Bowen's representatives pushed for a very high salary. Newcastle were interested in the player, but interested in him for the summer. Crystal Palace were also trying to get him, but Crystal Palace could only do it on a loan with an option to buy. That's been structured in an interesting way, in that the bonuses are very much performance related. So West Ham have sort of said to Hull City, if you believe in this player and you think he's going to do well in the Premier League, we're prepared to give you good bonuses according to that. So, for example, there's a bonus of £1 million if he plays for England. There's a bonus of £1 million if he signs a new contract at West Ham. He's on a 5.5-year deal initially. Another £1 million if he scores 10 Premier League goals in a season. Another 1.25 if he gets to 15. Another 1.5 if he gets to 20. So they can get up to 3.75 million in a season should he score at something close to the rate he's been scoring in the Championship. So he had 14 three seasons ago, 22 goals in the Championship last season. He had 16 in the Championship so far this season. And I think West Ham's thinking here is they're buying a player who has a lot of talent, can help them try and stay up. But if they don't stay in the division, they've got someone who's absolutely Championship ready. And I'm told that Bowen's agents tried to get a release clause involved in that deal on the condition that should West Ham go down, he'd be allowed to leave. And Sullivan held his ground, said absolutely no way. You want this deal to happen, you want the wages you're asking for, it's going to have to be no release clause. If you play well enough in this 6 months and score enough goals, you won't have to worry about that. And if you play well enough and score enough goals, then a Premier League club's going to come in and offer a substantial fee for you, so you'll get another Premier League club anyway. So, good example of the kind of bartering and tactics that are used on deadline day. I'll tell you, West Ham definitely paid more than they planned to pay for this, but they felt they needed the player to come in, and Bowen's representatives used the situation to try and extract the maximum financial terms. I believe he's got a pay rise of over three times his Hull City salary by moving to West Ham.
West Ham certainly looked all right going forward. It looked like the defence that was the bigger problem on Saturday. How do you rate their squads in terms of their ability to stay up and how David Moyes has gotten so far? Because it's not been the most auspicious of starts, is it?
Look, they've clearly got a squad that should be good enough to stay in the division. They've invested a lot of money in it over the last couple of years, and there's a substantial amount of talent in there. They've hired David Moyes because he is one, a known face to them. He kept them in the division before, and they decided to part company with him and follow the Manuel Pellegrini experiment. But also because he's a percentage manager. He's in some ways he's a kind of Scottish Sam Allardyce in that he knows the division and he'll play percentage football to try and keep you there. And I think I would expect them to stay up because they've got enough talent in their squad to get results to stay in the division, and they've got a manager who knows the division and has a track record of keeping teams up.
Well, one of the other big stories of the transfer window, but it didn't come to fruition, this one, was Newcastle's bid for Boubacary Soumaré. Can you enlighten us on the detail of that, Duncan?
Yeah, this is fascinating because Newcastle made a very substantial offer for Boubacary Soumaré, who is top talent at Lille, who is being watched by a lot of the leading European clubs with the consideration of trying to get him in the summer. Lille wanted to sell the player. They identified him as an individual that they were prepared to let go and cash in this window. They accepted an offer from Newcastle United for a figure that I'm told was €43 million guaranteed, plus a further €10 million of bonuses. The deal didn't go through because the player's agents persuaded him to stay. My information is that the player's agents, we've talked about this in the podcast before, were asking for a substantial percentage of the transfer fee to agree to that deal, a percentage that Leo felt was far too much for them to concede to allow the transfer to go ahead. They spent a lot of time trying to persuade the player. I think it's an indication of two things, that Soumaré and his agents think they will be able to get a better club in the summer, and generally that's because other clubs are tied down in their financial fair play budgets mid-season and want to wait until 1st July when a new season starts to do a deal of that nature. So I think we definitely need to pay attention to what goes on with Soumaré going forward, because I don't think this is the end of the story. He said he wants to stay at Lille, but he won't want to stay at Lille long term. And I think we're going to see more important and stronger clubs than Newcastle bid for them. It's also interesting that Newcastle put so much money down as an offer. Newcastle are not renowned for their largesse in the transfer market. This has happened at a time in which there is discussion of a takeover of Newcastle United. Now, that's not entirely novel, because there's been discussion of a takeover of Newcastle United in pretty much every transfer window for the last 5 years, it feels like. But this was real, genuine, and Leo would have sold if they could have convinced the player to go. And it tells you that perhaps something is changing at Newcastle United.
In terms of transfers and big money transfers at Newcastle, they haven't had a lot of luck. You think back to Joe Linton, who, well, he's almost become a meme, hasn't he, in terms of his inability to find the back of the net. Do you think that they have an issue with their transfer policy more generally, or do you see shoots of recovery in some of the signings that they have made there?
They've struggled with their signings, that's clear. You know, the big money deals they put down and forward players have struggled to score goals, but then they're coming into a team that plays extremely defensive football. Played extremely defensive football last season under Rafa Benitez. Effective, kept them in the division. A very capable coach using a reasonable squad of players to play deep defence, low block, organise the team well, take your opportunities on the break and grab your points where they can. They haven't changed very much under Steve Bruce. So you've got to say it's tough for players to come from who have never played in the Premier League before, as Joe Linton has never played in the Premier League, as Almiron has never played in the Premier League, and also to come from different continents and then be expected to perform. And when they're attacking players and you put them in a team that plays that fashion, it's going to be hard for them to score goals, and then the confidence can decline quite quickly. So do we expect Newcastle to solve their transfer policy while Mike Ashley is in charge of the club? I think the fundamental block there has been he's never wanted to spend really serious money on this team. It doesn't really seem to have been a joined up approach about the transfer business for a long time. And it will be interesting to see if that changes. Soumaré is, you know, that's a very ambitious move from Newcastle. If they got that, they got a player that the top clubs in Europe covet into their team by doing it in the January window when others weren't prepared to act. Like, you know, that you'd have to say that would have been something of a coup for them.
Well, from one failed transfer deal to another, one perhaps that less people know about because Sumare was all over the press. This one is Tottenham's attempts to sign Israeli international Eran Zavi, a player, Duncan, with a quite astonishing goal record when you look at what he's done over the last few years.
Yes, it's really interesting player, Zavi. Very much a left-field effort from Tottenham, a very, very late effort. The information I have from Israel is that they did not make contact with Zahavi and his camp until 7 o'clock on deadline day. And remember, this is a player who plays in China for Guangzhou. So at the time at which they made contact to try and get this deal over the line, it was 3 in the morning in China. I'm told by a friend of the player that it was very close to happening. And the block was that Guangzhou were prepared to let him go on loan to Tottenham, which was, as we've told you all through this window, Daniel Levy wanted a loan with an option to buy for this emergency Harry Kane replacement he was going to be bringing in. Guangzhou were ready to do that, but what they said to Zahavi was, we will only loan you if you sign a new contract. He's out of contract at the end of this year. But you sign that contract on substantially reduced financial terms. He's very well paid in China because he's been such a success there. He spent 3.5 years in the Chinese league. Last season, he scored 29 in 28 goals, which is the highest ever scoring return for a striker, for any player in the Chinese Super League. He's an interesting individual because he didn't play striker for most of his career. He was converted into a striker by Paulo Sousa at Maccabi Tel Aviv from being a midfielder. He from the time he became a striker, turned into a very prolific scorer, someone that Scotland fans will be paying attention to because he is going to be the centre forward for Israel when they play Scotland in the first of Scotland's European championship qualifiers.
Och, Duncan, we'll squish it.
Where does that confidence come from, Johnny?
Next. nowhere that's logical.
The plus side of this deal falling through for Scotland fans is that he's now struggling to play football before that March 26 qualifier. Chinese League is obviously not being played at the moment. He wanted to try and get football to prepare for that game. He hasn't been able to move to Europe. He's got very few options left to him. Major League Soccer would be one option. Again, that wouldn't give him much actual playing time before the tie. But I'm told Guangzhou are being very resistant and saying they don't want to sell the player. But an interesting move from Tottenham to try and give Mourinho the type of striker he wanted. And this is a player, obviously, Mourinho knew, having played against Maccabi Tel Aviv in the Champions League with Chelsea 2015, and Paulo Sousa being a friend of Mourinho's. So he would have had good knowledge on the player's qualities and his suitability to come into the team and solve that Harry Kane-shaped problem he has in Tottenham's squad at present.
We're going to move on to Pep Guardiola and Man City now. That's 6 league defeats so far this season. Some rather catty comments about the Premier League. The question I have here, Duncan, is this. Is the way Liverpool are running away with this league disguising what is quickly becoming something of a meltdown by Man City's Spanish boss here?
He's not happy, that's clear. He's not happy with Manchester City for the recruitment work they did in the summer. He's not happy with the authorities. He's not happy, I think, with good reason, with the refereeing of Manchester City games this season and VAR decisions that have gone against them. And, you know, you can track back to their first game against Tottenham where they had that ridiculous handball decision against Aymeric Laporte that stopped them from winning that match and set them behind, I think, Liverpool for the first time in the season. And then obviously the head-to-head with Liverpool was the infamous Trent Alexander-Arnold Schrödinger's handball, as we called it on the podcast, not given as a penalty, but Liverpool go up the other end and score the opening goal of the game. The rules, as ridiculously rewritten by the English authorities and accepted by IFAB for this season, say that you cannot have a handball in the build-up to a goal, but that one was permitted, and Liverpool won that match. And from then on, just created a larger and larger gap, and have the title very much won. There's a, if you watch the video of the press conference, it's quite amusing to look at Pep Guardiola's reaction when he's asked if he's conceded the league, and sort of responds to the journalist by making a face which suggests he thinks he's absolutely crazy to even ask that question. He's pushed on Liverpool's huge advantage, I think 22 points ahead, largest ever advantage the leaders have had over second place in a top flight season, and he's asked whether it's a problem for his team and also the rest of the Premier League that Liverpool are so far ahead. And his response, as you say, is fairly catty. It's, well, the last two seasons it was an owner from the Premier League said that cannot happen again. It's not good for the Premier League. City win the title in that way with 100 points. So now it's Liverpool, you have to be concerned, the owner for the Premier League. And he's talking there, he's referring there to Richard Scudamore, who is no longer the chief figure in the Premier League, but was at the time. And after Manchester City's 19-point win in 2018, was said on record that it would be good for the Premier League if someone was able to get a little bit closer to Manchester City. That obviously went down very badly with Guardiola, and Guardiola's trying to remind people about it and say, well, if it was so bad for the Premier League that Manchester City won by 19 points, what is this? What does this season mean for the Premier League? And are the senior people in the Premier League going to do anything about it, as they intimated that they might be trying to do when we were winning by such a huge margin?
Do you get a sense that he's going to get, should he be around? I mean, I'm assuming that he'll be the manager next year. I mean, I don't know if you think that's a definite or not, but should he be around, do you think Man City will invest heavily to rejuvenate this squad in the summer?
Absolutely. He's pushing them to spend and sort out what he says are mounting problems in the team. Obviously, they have big issues at centre-back. That was clear when Vincent Kompany was lost to them. They were caught by surprise by Kompany leaving for Belgium when they thought they would be able to extend his contract after he'd had such a fine end to last season. They lost Aymeric Laporte to injury early on, and that just exposed how weak their defence has been. You see John Stones completely left out of the squad for the game against Tottenham. The teenage Eric Garcia picked ahead of him to be on the bench, with Fernandinho playing as a converted midfielder in central defence again. Not happy at left back. You have the ongoing problem with Leroy Sané, who they do not know whether he will continue at the club, given Bayern Munich's interest in him, a story that was, you know, first reported on this podcast some time ago. Now, he wants to freshen up the squad. He feels that psychologically they've lost some of their hunger, and I think he knows that he's a difficult manager to work with. He's a very demanding manager to work with. And you can see from the first title he won at Manchester City and the first interview, long interview he gave after winning at Manchester City, his emphasis on how hard it was to win back-to-back titles, and kind of saying, well, the Champions League isn't the hardest thing for me. The hardest thing is to get this team to win two in a row, because winning one title is a lot easier than winning the second title when your players... you've got the risk your players sit back and think they're good enough and don't focus in the same way in the next season. So yes, you also see from his press conference ahead of the Tottenham game, him discussing the idea that he would be seen as a failure if he did not win the Champions League during his time at Manchester City. You can be sure that is very much on his mind. He has not won the Champions League without having Lionel Messi in his team. It's been a long time since he's won the Champions League. He's been hired by two clubs and given an unprecedented spending with the express aim of bringing them Champions League titles. He's failed to do that. And he knows that he will be judged on whether he can, with the, you know, the richest squad, most expensive squad in terms of transfer fee commitments that's ever been built in football, whether he can actually deliver that trophy to the Abu Dhabi owners of the club. And he wants a lot more spending, and he's arguing with them that they have to spend a lot more if they are going to achieve it and win the Premier League title back next season.
My argument, Duncan, is that this should be the year when the pressure is on for Guardiola to win the Champions League, because he doesn't have that fallback of saying, well, we're in the middle of this brutal, attritional Premier League title challenge. He is now able to actually select and rotate his team based on the key matches, which will be the Champions League games, because he doesn't have to prioritise Premier League games anymore. City will finish in the top four. There's no question of that. Is that a fair comment?
He is talking in the press conferences now about the importance of qualifying Manchester City for the league. But yes, it should not be difficult to get them into the Champions League next season. And he certainly does have the option of prioritising Champions League matches to try and right the wrongs of his previous knockout campaigns, where they've gone out to inferior squads every time and clubs that they should be eliminating after big, in more than one case, big tactical errors by Guardiola in the important games. There's a big focus there. You have to say the team, there is something wrong with the team, and it's a problem obviously with the defence, but it's also a problem with the attack, in that they're not putting away chances that they used to put away. And it's the game against Tottenham was a good example of that. They should have scored in the first half. They had far more shots on goal than Tottenham. Tottenham end up winning with 3 shots on goal, all on target, 2-0, take the 3 points. The elements aren't just not finishing and not defending well. You see an extra aggressivity to the way they play. The tactical fouling that has been so important to their success in the Premier League isn't being implemented as well. The game against Tottenham, Raheem Sterling was very fortunate not to see a straight red card for a tactical foul. Or an attempt to get the ball back as quickly as possible on the edge of the Tottenham area, which we'll see how serious the damage turns out to be to Dele Alli. It's a horrendous tackle if you watch it, particularly in slow motion, the amount of stress and movement that's placed on Dele's ankle by Sterling's challenge on him. Alexander Zinchenko had a bad studs-up challenge earlier in the game, and we're talking early in the first half, which the referee missed or excused. Someone was pointing out that Manchester City had 68% possession in the game, but they end up with 14 fouls relative to Tottenham's 8, and Tottenham obviously playing defensive football. You'd expect them to be fouling more. 5 yellow cards relative to Tottenham's 2, and 1 red card relative to Tottenham's 0. And as I say, it could have been more than 1 red card for the way they're playing. So the machine isn't functioning properly. And it's probably not a surprise that Guardiola's answer when the machine isn't functioning properly is, I need new players.
OK, well, we're going to move on to our heroes and villains round now. It's that time. I'm going to go first. My hero of the week is Glenn Murray, friend of the Transfer Window podcast. There's a lot of chat about Glenn perhaps going out on loan. There was interest, serious interest from Nottingham Forest. Up here in Scotland, both the Rangers and Celtic, I think, had a wee sniff, a wee nibble around Glenn. But nothing quite came off. And it looked like maybe he would languish in the reserves at Brighton. He's 36. And perhaps look to continue his career elsewhere at the end of the season. But he's obviously fought his way back into the reckoning. And against West Ham on Saturday, he led the line like a man who was 10 years younger. He was running down channels, bizarrely, which is not something we're used to seeing from Glenn. And he was even, you know, holding the ball up with his usual aplomb as well. And he capped it off with just a terrific goal which was held up for a VAR check. But Glenn was quite obviously completely intent that that ball did not hit him on the hand, and continued to celebrate regardless of the VAR check. And it was just magnificent to see a guy age 36 who's gone through a lot recently in terms of potentially leaving the club to come back and really restate his case for a place in that Brighton team. And we're talking about a guy who's had a bit of a journeyman career at times in the lower leagues, but since arriving at Brighton has found his home and has shown himself to be a fine, fine player in the Premier League. So it was good to see him back in the reckoning. So he's my hero of the week.
Yeah, look, Glenn has been desperate to play football, and now Brighton are put under a bit of pressure, and the results have been going the wrong way, brought into the team and delivers. And actually, if you look at the statistics, and there's some up on the Transfer Window podcast site, because a journalist mentioned that if Manchester United were going for players like Josh King and Ighalo, perhaps Glenn Murray might not have been a better short-term solution for them, given that he was proven in the Premier League and fit and ready to go. And his numbers, his scoring numbers in the Premier League, playing for a Brighton side who are been battling to stay in the division, are quite spectacularly good. And also his contribution off the ball was the one of the things that really impressed me about Glenn's numbers. So that running down the channel and running onto opponents, he actually does quite a lot of. Might not do it very quickly, but he does it. And yeah, you're right. It's good to see him scoring again, and hopefully we'll have Glenn on the podcast again before too long, because he's been very good as an analyst for us too.
Right, I've got the easy one, Duncan, because I'm praising somebody. So I'm Mr. Nice Guy. Now, you get to wear the villain hat. Who are you going to stick the boot into?
I'm going to pick, I think, the villain of the week for the Liverpool supporters, which was Ralf Hasenhüttl, who had the temerity to question the failure of VAR to give a penalty for Danny Ings after he'd been fouled by Fabinho in the area, with the score at 0-0 in that latest game in what has turned out to be Liverpool's procession to the title. And Hasenhüttl was asking why it took so little time for a decision to be made on the penalty, because not only were Southampton not given a penalty, Liverpool went up the other end of the field and scored. And Hasenhüttl says, the time of the decision the VAR took after the penalty we didn't get, it was, I think, 10 seconds. To be that clear that Ingsy was going down because of nothing, I don't know. But you must say, be brave at that moment, I think, to say, okay, no goal. We get penalty here at Anfield. That will not happen, I think. And I think Hasenhüttl is getting to the core of the problem, which is, or one of the many problems with VAR, which is it will tend to be biased towards the home side. How brave do you have to be to give the penalty to a Southampton side who probably had the better of the first half, definitely had the better chances in the first half, and might be a goal that ends that incredible run of victories at Anfield. I think that the pressure is going from being the person who stops Liverpool from winning the league for the first time in 30 years, because we know that's going to happen, to this pressure of being the one who stops this incredible run and being held responsible, potentially held responsible as the referee who gives a decision against Liverpool at Anfield that could end their run. And the start of that game, we saw Andy Robertson pass the ball back to Alisson Becker in goal, and Alisson Becker pick it up. And everyone, I think every neutral watching that thought, well, you don't get much more clear of a pass back than the one Robertson did. Yet no free kick was given, and it would have been a fascinating free kick because Becker picked it up about a foot from his post in the 6-yard area. And yeah, villain of the week for the Liverpool supporters, but I think Ralf Hasenhüttl makes a very valid point about the operation of VAR and one of the problems we have with it. And you know, it's quite hard to find people in the Premier League who are in favour of VAR. Now they've had, what is it, 6 months of having to play under it. It's telling how opinion has changed towards it and how problematic it's been in this season.
Duncan, we like to think of ourselves as the Thinking Man's Football Podcast. Perhaps not when I'm on, but generally with you and Ian McGarry. So we don't subscribe to conspiracy theories. However, you look at that kind of incident, and it was such a stonewall penalty. And you know I have Liverpool leanings, and I'm openly admitting that it was an absolute stonewaller. And you wonder how VAR, who have the facility to watch something over and over again, could get that quite so spectacularly wrong. I mean, here in Scotland, we don't have VAR, and the proponents of it say, well, you know, these kind of clear and obvious issues are going to get cleared up by the use of this technology. But here we have evidence of a situation that's almost quite remarkable that it wasn't spotted.
I don't think it was a stonewall penalty. I do think it was a penalty. But I think Hasenhüttl's point is the correct one here. It took VAR virtually no time to decide that an error had not been made. Whereas you have the Tottenham-Manchester City match, where VAR takes 2 minutes to intervene with Mike Dean and get him to stop play and decide that it was a penalty when Serge Aurier had taken Sergio Aguero down in the box. Now, the Aurier-Aguero one, I think, is less clean-cut, and I don't think it was a clear and obvious error. I think that there's an argument that Aurier got a touch to the ball just after Aguero deflects it away. And under the guidelines, it has to be clearly wrong. And it wasn't, in my view, clearly wrong. And if it takes 2 minutes to come to that decision, then the common sense approach is that it isn't clear and obvious that there's been an error. The system is not working well, and it will not fix things. And if, you know, Scottish football thinks it's going to be a panacea, it really needs to pay more attention to what's going on in England and the degree of resistance from players, from coaches, from staff. And I don't think there's any conspiracy theory here about people actively trying to help Liverpool win the league. But I think there are pressures on the officials. And as we know that officials are biased towards home teams, and we know they're biased towards bigger teams. This is, you know, scientifically demonstrated.
Spoken like a true Dundee United fan there.
And years of suffering under the Celtic Rangers refereeing Oak. But we know these things. Liverpool prides itself on the power of its support at Anfield. They are a big, influential club, and it's fairly logical to say that referees are under pressure to give decisions in Liverpool's favour in a way that they wouldn't be if it was a Brighton and Hove Albion game, for example. And therefore, Liverpool have had the rub of the green when it comes to refereeing decisions this season in the round. And VAR decisions in the round. And I think there's good evidence for that. That's not a conspiracy theory. That's highlighting an issue with the decisions that have been made and with the technology that allows two shots of favouritism for the bigger side or the home side. Because you've got not only the pressure on the referee, you've got the VARs having pressure on them. So you've got two options to correct it and help the bigger sides. And I think when someone has the ability to do a proper statistical analysis on this, you will see that it comes out. We've seen it in the Champions League. We saw last season, we've seen it this season, Real Madrid getting absurd decisions in their favour in key games in the Champions League. Who are more important to UEFA? Who are officials under pressure to keep in the tournament? Real Madrid or Ajax or Club Brugge? It's an easy question to answer. And you get these kind of problems coming from the system.
Okay, well, we're going to call a day there. If you want to continue the debate or discuss with us anything that we've talked about on the podcast today, you can get me at Johnny R. McFarlane and Duncan at Duncan Castles. We'd also like you to go on iTunes and give us a 5-star review, as this helps us get the podcast to as many listeners as possible. We'll be back on Wednesday to answer your questions, so get onto social media. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, and we're on Twitter, and give us questions for that podcast, which we'll be delighted to answer. Until then, thanks for listening.